You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Next up on Destination Freedom.
And let me just add to that, because we know that the prison industrial complex need raw material.
Right.
Like any manufacturer or factory, the raw material for the prison industrial complex are people, mainly black and brown people. And we do know that our society has been extremely over-punitive when it came down to people of color. Mm-hmm. I was on the state parole board here in Colorado back in the early 1990s, and I remember talking with one of the state senators, and his whole idea about the prison system was that he wanted to build more and more prisons, even privatize them, because that would reduce the crime rate. And he called it being tough on crime. I call it being stupid on crime, because you cannot build enough prisons for people, because lawmakers believe that their job is to make more laws. Right. Every year there's more laws being created to criminalize more type of behaviors. So there's no way to actually build our way out of this crime problem that we have in America. We just simply need to become smart on crime.
Welcome to Destination Freedom Black Radio Days podcast, a copyrighted program of No Credits Production, LLC. I'm producer, director, Donnie L. Betts. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Anthony Young. Dr. Young has been practicing mental health in Colorado for over 40 years. He has a doctorate in clinical psychology from the University of Denver. He has taught psychology courses for 26 years at the University of Colorado. In the past, Dr. Young has partnered with the Department of Corrections and the Mental Health Institute in Pueblo, Colorado. Currently, he is the president of Denver Rocky Mountain Association of Black Psychologists. Next on Destination Freedom, our conversation with Dr. Tony Young. And now, Destination Freedom. We're honored to have as our guest Dr. Anthony P. Young, who is the executive director and president of Denver Rocky Mountain Association of Black Psychologists. And he has years and years of experience. We're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about how people of color and black people in particular are dealing with their mental health issues, not only just in day-to-day life, but in particular now because of the pandemic, COVID-19. Dr. Young, welcome to Destination Freedom Black Radio Days podcast.
Well, thank you, Donnie. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, you have a lot, and we have worked together several times on this radio show in a different format. That is when we did when we were doing the radio drama series, which we still do. But now I want to talk to you today about real mental health issues. And there have been a lot of things that are happening this year in 2020, not including the pandemic. So first we're going to start out about how do you think people of color and black people in particular have been dealing with, and what can they do to just make themselves be better when they're dealing with things of systemic racism and also the protests that happened over the summer and continue to happen throughout the country?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let me say that it's our existence as a people in this country has always been challenging. There's not been one day since we were kidnapped and enslaved and brought to the Americas that we have not been subjected to terrorism. To be real clear, we have constantly been under assault. So we've dealt with this ongoing pandemic, if you will, of white supremacy. to be polite, we call it racism, but it's been subjugation in every area of our existence. So that's been one thing that we've had to deal with. Now, of course, we have COVID-19 virus to contend with. But the one thing that I can say without a shadow of a doubt, and that's the fact that African-Americans are resilient people to have dealt with over 400 years of white supremacy and now another pandemic, because we have survived pandemics before. It's just one more thing that we have to contend with. But we are the descendants of people who were quite strong, the ones who cannot be killed. So we have a lot to remember in terms of just recognizing our own strength as a people. We know that individually we can be overwhelmed, but collectively we have always been able to beat the odds against the odds, given our will to survive and to strive. So with that in mind, that's the framework that I would like to set our discussion with. Because too often times we don't think about resilience. We think about just simply suffering, but being able to not just overcome the obstacles that we'll face, but to really strive beyond what is the apparent struggle immediately is so important.
And talking about that resilience, I'm glad you brought that up and as a way to frame our conversation today. Yes, we as a people have been tremendously resilient throughout the years, over 400 years plus that we've been here on these shores of the United States of America. However, I always said that people like myself, like you and other people of color need to be in therapy every day. That used to be what I used to say. And people say, well, what do you say that? You know, why do you say that? What do you mean that? What will you mean by that? I said, because a lot of time we have that stigma that we shouldn't seek help. We are resilient. Oh. Yes. But mm-hmm. also we need something else too. Sometimes we need just a little bit of help. Sometimes, you know, the community might not be someone that we can reach out to. A family may not be available for us to reach out to. A spouse or siblings may not be able to reach out to you. How do you now, with that person who may not have that support system, help themselves in especially times like these? But just like I said, in day-to-day life, they may be lost their housing. They may have lost their job, whatever the case may be. What can they mm-hmm. do to help themselves?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's so important that we remember that just like when we have physical challenges, if we break our arm or our leg, we don't hesitate to seek out a physician. The same thing is true in terms of our mental well-being. All of us have psychological challenges, which can really test our ability to cope. So just like we would seek help from a physician for medical conditions, we should not hesitate to seek out counselors, therapists, psychologists, people who have the expertise to be objective and to help us learn skills and to overcome the challenges that we're faced. However, I might give you an example from my life. I grew up in Chicago on the South Side. I'm the youngest of three sons. And no one on the South Side of Chicago ever had a psychological problem while I was growing up. I grew up during the 50s and 60s there. However, while we didn't identify psychosis as being an issue, we had uncles and aunties who had what we call nervous breakdowns.
Yes,
and there would be a sense away, so to speak, for months and even years sometime. And when people ask, well, what happened to Uncle Joe or Aunt Sally? Well, they had to go away. They had a nervous breakdown. The fact of the matter is that there was such a stigma attached to having psychological problems that people in my community would never admit that they had to go away to a mental health institute rather than just simply giving the acknowledgement of that. It would be said, well, they just had a nervous breakdown. So in other words, they just got nervous and they broke down and had to go away. But we know that the stigma attached to having mental health challenges is such that it's seen as being something to be ashamed of. It's a sign of weakness. And of course, our major media have always stigmatized mental health challenges. So no one wants to be seen as being quote unquote crazy. I mean, really, when you look at mental wellness, it exists on a continuum. On one end, you have people who are quite adept. They just simply need assistance to get better than what they are. And on the other extreme, you have people who are so out of contact with reality that they oftentimes need medication just to stabilize their condition so that they can come closer into contact with reality and begin to work on the issues which they're being challenged with. But most of us exist somewhere in that middle, and we can vacillate from one extreme to the other depending upon what challenges we're being faced with. So I would like to just say that when we think about mental wellness, it is something which is, it's a dynamic state. It's not stagnant. We're not mentally healthy in the true sense. It's just that we are on this continuum. And once again, based upon what we are challenged with, it may cause us to not work as effectively on our problems as we can. So being able to destigmatize appropriate help-seeking behavior is something that we have to constantly work on, because too oftentimes we may seek help from our minister. And it's wonderful that we use the faith-based community to engage in some type of help. But they're not mental health experts. They can help us spiritually, perhaps, but definitely not necessarily from a psychological vantage point, because that's not their training, that's not their background. The best thing a minister can do is to help connect someone with a mental health professional who are being challenged so that they can get the appropriate help that they need. And that's not to minimize the value that the faith-based community have. They definitely have their value, like medical professions have theirs. But when it comes to psychological challenges, which we all have from time to time, it's essential that we seek appropriate help. Our best friend can help us by getting us to a place where we can receive help, maybe help us set up an appointment, but they cannot be our therapist because they simply don't have the skill, even though they love us dearly. And the same would be true of family members.
So I'm glad you brought that up too as well, the faith-based, what everybody's role is, what you're really saying. Everybody has that lane that they're, yes, that strength lies in. And so not being willing to step outside that lane sometimes, I think, can hurt us. A couple of things I want to talk about in particular. Well, actually three things, and it comes to kind of generational thing. First is, let's talk about our younger people, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about how health professionals can seek help themselves, because I think, you know, in this time, that's a lot of what's happening as well too. They're being totally burned out, that sort of thing. And I bring up children first because they're being impacted in ways that we never experienced before. A, having to be not being able to socialize with their peers, being able to socialize in school like they normally have, being able to socialize with their families, you know. So that separation, I think, is really causing a strain, not just on adults like myself, not being able to see grandkids and kids and things like that, but the younger people themselves. What advice would you have for, say, parents or grandparents or, like you said, siblings or older siblings to deal with younger people who are now having some of these issues that they can't seek help and find the answers they need by social media, or if they are, maybe it's the wrong kind of message that's being sent to them. What advice would you have for them?
Well, once again, depending upon their age range, we're talking about very, very young children, let's say between the ages of 1 and 8. One of the things that can help a lot is to help parents create routines for children, and these routines can certainly include something educational, something fun, but really to spend time speaking and interacting with their children without being judgmental, because certainly children oftentimes will exhibit depression as being anger, as a feeling of anger. So it may not be obvious when a child is actually feeling sad. And with teenagers, the same is true as well. Sadness and depression may take the form of anger and, of course, maybe even some substance involvement. So one of the things that parents can do certainly is to pay attention to what their children are saying and also what they're feeling, what they're sharing with them, and being as much as possible to engage them in activities that, that can bring them joy. We know that with this social distancing, it doesn't mean social isolation. So there's ways in which we can connect within the home through hobbies, through having discussions about TV programs that may have some socially redeeming values, by being able to use the technology to connect with other relatives and friends over the internet through platforms such as Zoom and Google Meets and all the rest, but really paying attention to what type of behaviors and verbiage our children are using so that we can be in tune with them rather than being disconnected, because too often times we know that people can live in the same household and be quite disconnected. What I'm saying is that we have to be very intentional about paying attention and being attuned to our children as well as other members of our household. That will really save us a lot of pain and anguish that will occur otherwise. And there's one more thing I would like to mention. It's very important that as parents give themselves, and also even if you're not a parent, give yourself permission to be tired, to be angry, to be depressed, and to remember that you're human also. So just because you might be a caregiver or a spouse or a mate or a parent, you have these feelings too, but being able to acknowledge them, don't try to stuff the feelings, because that doesn't help. It's almost like sweeping garbage under a rug. Eventually you'll trip over it.
You're right. Right.
So being able to just acknowledge where you're at and to give yourself permission to be human. And then once again, to engage in appropriate help seeking behavior. One thing that people can do certainly is to limit their exposure to the news. Usually, if you are an adult, you might watch the morning news, the afternoon news, since many people are working from home, and the evening news and the 10 o'clock news. And typically, the talking heads are saying the same thing, and usually they're giving us bad news.
Right.
So being able to just limit our exposure to maybe one time a day, watch the morning news and maybe the next day. Because the news does not change that much in 24 hours.
Right.
So you don't really have to inundate yourself with a lot of negativity. And also, something else that people can do to help deal with these pandemics that we've been involved with is to meditate, and certainly to pray, to engage in hobbies, to understand that the danger in which we are experiencing, the danger of both white supremacy and COVID-19, danger is real, but fear is a choice. And we can choose not to live our lives in fear despite the circumstances that we're faced with every day.
So you brought up fear, because I think fear is what leads into and drives racism as one of the things. To pick out an athlete, LeBron James said something really interesting. Mm-hmm. He said, we're afraid every day. We as black people are afraid every day, especially as black men, black women, black children. We are afraid every day. Meditation, I think, will definitely help. And like I said, turning off the news and, you know, putting that down and not be so consumed by it, because it's like I said, negativity rules and also rules fear and strikes fear in the hearts of individuals. I think that's excellent advice. I want to talk now about how people who are the medical professional who are getting slammed now can help themselves. And so many know what to do, but I don't know if they're opposed to do it, but just feel they can't do it, or what the case may be. What would be your advice to someone who's doing it every day? They've done 4 or 5 18-hour shifts in a row, you know, what can they do to help themselves?
Well, certainly they're faced with a condition which we've not seen in this lifetime before. The challenges which our first responders, particularly our medical professionals, have to contend with. So once again, it's very important that they take care of themselves. The question becomes, who cares for the caregivers?
Right.
Who cares for our medical professionals, the doctors and nurses, the CNAs and the other people who provide first line care for people who are suffering and oftentimes dying? So it's important that as much as I realize it's difficult, they have to make time for themselves. You cannot work 12, 14, 18 hours a day and not have detrimental effects upon your mind, body, and your spirit. So being able to step away, even if it's an hour, you have to make time for yourself just in terms of being able to rejuvenate all of the things that allow it to be possible for you to do the type of work that you do. And to certainly, as much as possible, eat healthy. Too oftentimes, people who are inundated with demands have to eat on the run, but we know that that can have very detrimental effects upon us as well, because we have our body and our minds need nutrition. And when we don't make the time, it just has a cumulative effect upon further deteriorating our condition, our stress level. So being able to be mindful of the fact that while you're caring for other people, care for yourself, because without that, you won't be in a position to care for others. So as the old saying goes, I guess in the Bible, charity starts at home. Care for others begins with care for yourself, first and foremost.
Seniors, let's talk about seniors. Now, what can our seniors do to help themselves, and especially in this time?
Well, that's a tough one. In our society, unfortunately, people who are seniors too oftentimes are pushed to the side. They're put into nursing homes. They're put into places where they're isolated, and that our community cannot benefit from their presence because they're being ostracized or pushed to the side. So it's very important that people engage the seniors by maybe developing a regular routine to be in contact, either by telephone or by one of the social media platforms like Zoom, but just routinely make time to let the seniors know that they're loved and that people care about them, adds value to their lives. The thing that seniors can do themselves, of course, is to engage in the same type of behavior, reaching out to others, not allowing themselves to be socially isolated, despite the fact that we have to social distance. And all of the things which I would suggest to younger people, I would also suggest for seniors as well, such as eating healthy, meditating, avoiding toxic substances, including alcohol and any other thing which might toxifying. Also, it's very important that as much as possible for seniors and others to avoid toxic people. Because we know that some people can be a vexation to yes. one's existence by the yes. type of negativity that they may bring. So being able to just really avoid people, prevent people from being in contact with you as much as possible who bring negativity.
Don't bring me no bad news.
Absolutely. We need to have as much joy and positivity in our lives to help us combat all of the stressors that we're faced with on a day-to-day basis, and many times, several times a day.
So one of the things I know I've spoken with you in the past, and I've heard you speak about too, is, and this leads into the question about how the people who have been leading protests or not just in the street, but on social media, in their communities, or on the organization that they run or have just formed, You used to always say, know your history. What do you mean by
that? Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm going to give you a couple of African proverbs to answer that. One goes like this. If you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you are. If you don't know where you are, you don't know where you are going. And if you don't know where you are going, any fool can take you there. Mm. And we know that our history has been distorted, destroyed, and really debased in a lot of insidious ways to keep people of African descent from recognizing the strength that we have. A lot of the stereotypes are just really based and founded in white supremacist ideology about that black people are inferior, that we had no civilization before we were kidnapped, enslaved, and raped and murdered and tormented for hundreds of years by Europeans, that we actually had no civilization. But the truth of the matter is that it's just the opposite, because African people created the first civilizations on the planet. The Africans in northeastern Africa actually had one of the longest, over 3,000 years of civilization, longer than anything that the Romans or the Greeks could even imagine. In fact, they didn't even exist while we were building the pyramids and creating the foundations for all of the sciences which exist today, medicine, including architecture and law and you name it. We already have the foundations for that for thousands of years. And the Greeks and the Romans came to Africa, Northeast Africa, Egypt, or Kemet to be more exact, to actually learn. So the lies which have been taught about black people is that we are inferior, and it's just completely false. But our educational system has historically taught the lies of white supremacy, the lies of racism, that the European was the epitome of what it meant to be good and smart and intelligent, etc., when really Europeans had absolutely no right to hold themselves as being the universal standard of anything other than for themselves.
But
too often times our educational system has pushed the lie of white superiority and black inferiority. And if you happen to be a person of color somewhere between black and white, you were always seen as lesser than that of the Caucasian. So it's something that we need to dispel and eradicate, because it's very harmful. We know that the bottom line for white supremacy, it was primarily designed to keep black people from competing. And also you was used to destroy hope. And we know that when we destroy hope, we destroy life.
Man, yes, absolutely, I agree. We're speaking with Dr. Anthony Young, who's the president of the Denver Rocky Mountain Association of Black Psychologists, just about a variety of subjects. In particular, we're talking about the mental health, well-being of people of color, of black people in particular, not only just during this pandemic, but also just in everyday life as we live our lives and go on and be human beings. One of the things you talk about too that I've heard you speak about a lot is identifying fear, what your fear is holding you back from achieving your goals. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Fear can be very paralyzing. And it keeps people from acting in ways which would be to their best benefit. So oftentimes when we find ourselves living in fear, we just simply don't look at all of the possibilities that can help us resolve whatever situation that we're faced with. In fact, there's an interesting song that goes something like this. It's the name of the song is Imani. And it's one of the songs that we use on Kwanzaa to help inspire. And one of the refrains in the song goes something like this: live life by faith and not by your fear. And when we live our life by our faith, we can recognize the fact that we have abilities, we have resources, we have support systems that we can tap into to allow us to not just overcome the problems that we have, but to really create possibilities for being, for beingness, for being better. As Spike Lee would say, to be mo' better. and we can only do this when we recognize that we're not prisoners except within the mental prisons that we create for ourselves. And fear represents a mental prison. It represents a psychological incarceration of our possibilities.
Quickly, you're talking about prisons, but let's talk about really mass incarceration, or how people who are incarcerated now are probably dealing with mental health issues. Got about 30 seconds.
Okay, very quickly. I'm a past chairman of the Colorado State Board of Parole, and I've served under two governors, Governor Romer and Governor Hickenlooper. I can tell you that in prison, there's very, very little mental health treatment provided. Typically, what is available would be psychoeducational groups, substance abuse groups, but there's really no substantial psychological assistance given to people who are in prison. The best thing that we can do as a community is to make sure that when these returning citizens come back to our community, that we have the resources available to deal with their behavioral health needs, the housing, the employment, and their behavioral health needs, so that we can have more support for them. That would help to eradicate some of the mental health challenges that they will have returning back to our community.
We're talking about the mental health issues that exist with our communities that are incarcerated. In particular, I know that it's a disproportionate amount of people of color that are in our prison system. Can you speak on that? Because you have such a vast experience in that area.
Yes, Donnie. First, let me say that I served twice on the State Parole Board here in Colorado, once under Governor Romer in the 1990s, and then as chairman of the State Parole Board under Governor Hickenlooper during his first term. And I've worked in criminal justice in forensics and clinical psychology for about 40 plus years in Colorado. And one of the issues is that there's a disproportionate number of African Americans and people of Hispanic descent who are incarcerated. Now, I would dare say that that people of color do not have any greater proclivity toward criminal behavior than people of European descent. It's just that the criminal justice system has been quite racist, and we find that people of color, particularly African Americans, are more likely to be charged, arrested, incarcerated disproportionately rather than people who are of European descent. And that's a reflection of the racism, not just in policing, but also in the judiciary, and of course, when it comes to the prison system as a whole. Individuals who are incarcerated, by and large, receive very, very little behavioral health treatment while they're incarcerated. There may be some substance abuse groups, and maybe some group therapy dealing with anger management, but there's very, very little, because within the correctional system, behavioral health issues take a lesser priority, because the biggest priority is about keeping people incarcerated and isolated from society. So when we think about the whole issue about rehabilitation, it's a bad joke, because many people do not need rehabilitation. They need habilitation, if you know what I mean. Mm. We don't want to return them to a previous state, because that previous state may have been dysfunctional.
Right.
So when we think about the type of help that people need who are incarcerated, certainly behavioral health treatment, oftentimes medication is needed, but also being able to assist those people who have poor educational achievement. What would happen if inmates were allowed to attend college while they're incarcerated? Would that, in fact, increase the possibility of their employability after incarceration? Most likely. However, we still have the stigma about people who are commonly called ex-offenders, ex-felons, et cetera, rather than just simply saying these are returning citizens. These are people who are our cousins, our brothers, our neighbors, our relatives, our friends, people that we grew up with, who may have made some poor decisions and ended up being incarcerated. These are returning citizens who are going back to the very communities that they left to begin with. So we have a responsibility to embrace them and to welcome them back into our community with a hope that that they can actually get on a better footing, and that through our acceptance, they can move on with their lives in some positive way, rather than constantly punishing them because they made some poor choices, perhaps. So rather than denying housing, educational loans and grants and employment, what would happen, in fact, if our community would actually welcome these individuals back and provide some opportunities so that it would be less likely that they would be falling back into previous patterns of behavior which are non-functional or dysfunctional for them. That's our challenge as a community. So the faith-based community, as well as the political structure within our society, has both failed in that regard.
I don't know if you saw the piece last recently on 60 Minutes, where I think it was Kenya, where they were allowed in prisoners to, there was a young gentleman out of South Africa who became a lawyer. I think he originally was a doctor. And he started a program where it would allow prisoners to attend college at the University of London. And, you know, virtually, and sometimes having the staff and professors come there as well. And they were becoming lawyers themselves and defending themselves and changing the justice system there in Kenya. So it was just amazing. Like you said, they're giving people opportunity to change their life. Most people will take advantage of it. You know, of course, some people won't. Some people are just who they are, you know.
Yes.
But for the majority of the people that were in the story, and this included guards as well, too. The guards wanted to, because they didn't want to be, like they said, you know, having their brothers and sisters like this. They wanted to have them opportunity to be good contributing citizens to the society. It only made it a strong society if everybody contributed.
I think
I think that's what you say. One of the failings of our country is that they don't want everybody to contribute to society. They want to have and have not society. And that's really been relevant and relevant and evident in the pandemic, is to have and have not.
Absolutely. And let me just add to that, because we know that the prison industrial complex need raw material.
Right.
Like any manufacturer or factory, the raw material for the prison industrial complex are people, mainly black and brown people. And we do know that our society has been extremely over punitive when it came down to people of color. Mm-hmm. I was on the state parole board here in Colorado back in the early 1990s. And I remember talking with one of the state senators. And his whole idea about the prison system was that he wanted to build more and more prisons, even privatize them, because that would reduce the crime rate. And he called it being tough on crime. I called it being stupid on crime, because you cannot build enough prisons for people, because lawmakers believe that their job is to make more laws. Every year, there's more laws being created to criminalize more type of behaviors. So there's no way to actually build our way out of this crime problem that we have in America. We just simply need to become smart on crime. What would happen if the punishment for crime was actually commensurate to the offense itself? Mm-hmm. Rather than sending someone to prison for non-payment of child support, we would all agree that people should take care of their own kids, perhaps, if they're able. But what would happen if rather than sending someone to prison for $30,000 a year, we actually put them into a halfway house and have them work so they can take care of their families and take care of themselves?
Right.
Rather than what has happened traditionally. So same thing would be true about substance use. We have incarcerated thousands and thousands of people who were substance abuse users rather than providing treatment for them within our community. So we've been very, very foolish on crime, and we've not used the resources of our community and of our government effectively, because the prison industrial complex just simply is self-perpetuating. So we need to not just think outside of the box. When we think about what people call as prison reform, we need to throw the box away. We need to reconceptualize how we treat people who have made poor choices and harmed other people, and at times even harmed themselves in our society. We have to rethink this. And I do believe that as Americans, we have enough brain power to do that. We just simply have lacked the political will to do anything better than what was done.
Well, I think that would also go to, it's not the prison, let's talk about the fact that people want to, when it comes to police reform, and I use that term reform too, because they need to be reformed as well too. What are your thoughts on that? You know, before the person hits the system, how can we help these in the training of police officers to, so that the person does not ever hit the system?
Well, there's a lot of issues there. First of all, those of us who know anything about how the police system in this country developed during the time of slavery mm-hmm. we know that it was never about really anything other than keeping black people and other people of color in check, in their place. And of course, it expanded its role throughout the years. But the bottom line is that as an institution, policing has always been racist at its core. That's why even in cities where you have a vast majority of people who are African-American, the majority of the police force are not African-American. And we do know that, and this is well documented by the U.S. Department of Justice, that there are any number of racist groups functioning within police departments, including the KKK, the neo-Nazis, et cetera. So we cannot expect for people who have that mentality to be fair and just when they encounter people of color. That just does not happen. And the killings that were seen by police officers speak to that. But one part of your question dealt with what can be done about the training of police. First of all, police departments have not been conscientious, in my opinion, about the type of people that they've hired. There have been known individuals who have had psychological issues, who have had various racist attitudes and histories of violent behavior toward people of color who were hired. They would maybe leave one police department and go to another and carry on the same type of behavior. So the psychological profile of someone who we entrust with a badge and a gun must be at a much higher standard than what we've seen heretofore, because there are definitely many people who should have never been on the police force. And as we look at our history in this country of lynching and of police killings in various ways, those incidents could not have occurred unless law enforcement was involved in some way directly or complicit. And I think anyone who have read any of the books by Ida B. Wells can see the type of documentation which supports that comment that I just made.
Well, I know you don't have a ton of time. I'm gonna leave it there. And Dr. Young, I can't thank you enough for being with us on Destination Freedom Black Radio Days. Continued success to you, continued good health, and we'll speak again in the near future. All the best to you.
I appreciate that, Donnie. And hey, brother, stay well, stay blessed, and hey, let's be in touch.
All right, you take good care.
Okay, peace.
That concludes this episode of Destination Freedom Black Radio Days. Our producer and director, Danielle Betts. Support for Destination Freedom is provided by the Bonfils Stanford Foundation, the Ulipians Fund of the Denver Foundation, Arts and Society, and Karen and Johnny Klein. Destination Freedom Black Radio Days is produced by Danielle Betts. The series is remixed by Maurice Smith, a.k.a. Reese. Make sure you check us out at nocredits.com and pick up our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Radio Public, Spotify, etc. Follow us at Twitter at Donnie Betts, hashtag No Credits Production LLC, hashtag Black Radio Days, hashtag Destination Freedom Black Radio Days. Thank you for listening. Down.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.